I think a little menace is fine to have in a story. For one thing, it's good for the circulation. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 15 of Making Comics Gutter Talk. My name is Adam Greenfield. I am the host. We have a pretty killer show today. But before we get into that, that quote was from Raymond Carver. In my opinion, probably the greatest short story writer ever. E-V-E-R, ever. If you don't know who Raymond Carver is, he was a short story, very prolific short story writer in the mid to late 20th century. And some people have dubbed him the grandfather of short story writing. So I wholeheartedly agree with that. So if you don't know any Raymond Carver, go check out, what we talk about when we talk about love, or, many of his numerous stories. So definitely check out Raymond Carver. All right. Enough gushing over my man crush for Raymond Carver. Next weekend, if you are in Anaheim, so are we. We're going to be at WonderCon April 18th through the 20th. We have a panel on the 19th, Saturday the 19th from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. That is in room 210A. It's called Making Comics with the World. And check out these people. We got Jason Brubaker, creator of Cythra, Remind, Unnatural Talent. We got Shelley Cuvion and Rachel Beck from Storyforge Productions, as well as a group of us from MakingComics.com. We got Patrick Urich, the CEO, Kevin Cullen, the content editor, I guess you could say, the director of content, the person that decides what you get to read, when you get to read it, and Devin, the editor-in-chief, as well as yours truly, Adam. I think you know my name. I said it earlier, about a minute and a half ago. So yeah, check it out. WonderCon next weekend, the 19th, 4 to 5. It's going to be a pretty good one. If you're in Anaheim, if you're not, you're missing out. This episode is actually one that was requested by a listener, Michael Freely. Thank you very much for the suggestion. This is Jim Zub. He is an artist, a writer, an instructor. He worked on things such as Skull Kicker, Samurai Jack. Currently is working on several projects, from Red Sonja and Cub to Disney Kingdoms. And he is just a fountain of knowledge. So this one was recorded about a month or so ago, and I've talked to a lot of people since then, so I don't remember a lot of this conversation, so I am thoroughly looking forward to sitting down and listening to this. So let's go ahead and walk this path together. Jim Zub.
Anyway, all right. So we'll go ahead and we'll get this started. We are joined by Jim Zub. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
Doing very well. We're also joined by Mark Litke. How you doing, Mark?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Good, good. All right, so, Jim, give us a little background. Where are you from? Have you always been, were you born and raised? Where you're at?
Yeah, I'm not too far from where I currently am. I'm living in Toronto, Canada, up here in Ontario, and I grew up about maybe an hour and a half away from here in a little city called Oshawa. It's like a little blue-collar GM town here in Ontario. So, coming to Toronto when I was a kid was like going to the big city, and I always wanted to live in a bigger city and sort of be a part of that. So now I'm here. Yeah, I've moved around Canada previously. I was in Calgary for a little while and Halifax for a bit as well, but Toronto's been home for quite some time now.
Are you a big fan of Toronto compared to the others, or do you have a preference? Or
Every city is kind of different. Calgary and Halifax have some advantages. I liked some of the, the bigger the city, the more variety there is, and that can be really wonderful, but there's a nice sense of community when you're in a smaller place as well. Even still, I do love the big city, and I love being downtown. It's where I want to be, totally.
Was there one that had maybe a bigger comic scene over the other that...
Oh, Toronto's definitely got the largest comic scene of any of the cities I've been to. There's a great comic book community here. There's great comic book shows, sort of all sizes. There's a wonderful creator-specific festival called the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, TCAF, that runs here in May. And then there's also like a big anime show, and then there's the biggest comic and sort of pop culture show in Canada also runs here. So it's the biggest city in Canada, so it's got kind of all of that going for it. And the comic community is really great. The number of creators here is kind of staggering. You've got guys like Francis Manapul and Jeff Lemire and Stuart Immonen, Ray Fox and Ryan North, and sort of just a huge spread of both indie webcomic and then, you know, big two creators. Just a wonderful cross-section of comics here.
Cool.
So do you find that living in the big city is particularly beneficial to not necessarily breaking into the comic scene, but just kind of really being productive and getting known? Or does it not really matter so much anymore with the internet?
I think the internet has closed a lot of those gaps. I mean, being at conventions, being in person, I think makes a big difference. I attended conventions for years before I really started, you know, kind of doing more, I guess what you'd call mainstream stuff. So it's definitely a factor, but you don't need to be, you know, as there, you know, there as readily now with the internet. I think that it's closed kind of those gaps for a lot of people where you can find like-minded people and find creators. I mean, some people benefit from having community very close where that drives them to create, and some people, you know, they sort of work in solitude and then they like getting together once the work is done and sort of celebrating that. And so it's nice to have it on hand. You know, I have a lot of friends who are doing comics. And I've gotten to know a lot of people here in Toronto that do comics, but it's not, I don't think it's the end all be all. Like, you know, back in when I was growing up, it was like that feeling that if you weren't in New York City, you were never going to get a job at, you know, Marvel and DC unless you like were a really big name. And I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think that you can be pretty much anywhere if you've got the drive and if you've got the work.
What was your first introduction then? Into comics, and also I guess into being the artist as well.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, I went through multiple phases of kind of comic discovery and comic reading. The first comics I really remember collecting and really digging into, other than just sort of casual reading, you know, young kid, the G.I. Joe cartoon came out, and they had at the end of the cartoon during the credits, they'd have this thing right after all the credits came, but before the big Marvel logo, it would just say, or the Hasbro logo. It would say, buy the Marvel comic, and it would just sort of spin the new cover for the latest issue, and I was just like, yes, master, you know, go forth and buy the. So I started collecting the G.I. Joe comics, and then saw the ads for the other superhero comics and quickly moved over to Spider-Man. Spider-Man was probably my favorite, you know, growing up, but I started collecting those pretty voraciously. And then my brother and I started just sort of expanding out into the Marvel universe, so we would buy... By the time Secret Wars 2 came out, we were buying most of the Marvel Universe, so we sort of split it in twain. It's like he was buying most of the X-Men books and the related mutant books, and I was buying Spider-Man. There was like three Spider-Man titles at that point. You know, we would buy the Avengers, and we'd buy Doctor Strange, and we'd buy Thor, and, you know, we were big fantasy buffs. Absolutely loved, you know, sword and sorcery stuff and Dungeons and Dragons. And so any character that kind of mixed magic and... superhero stuff like Doctor Strange or Thor was like big deal for me growing up. That was huge. And then slowly but surely, you know, as the kind of 90s boom and the Image boom and all that stuff sort of ripped through everything, and by the time, I guess you get, you know, as a lot of other people made their exodus, you know, with the death of Superman and everything, I was already kind of moving out of superhero comics, and then I sort of moved sideways over to discovering the first translated mangas that were coming out around that same time as the early Image books. And so you're talking about like Masamune Shiro stuff, Ghost in the Shell, and Akira, and Appleseed, and all sorts of titles like that. So I moved into that sort of space for a few years and was still really kind of into that stuff as I finished high school and went off to college. And then when I was at college, some friends of mine had shown me, like, it seems weird now because the internet is so prevalent in our lives, but moving to college meant that I had a regular internet connection and an email address, which was not the norm. You know, we're talking 90, 92, 93.
You sound about my age.
Yeah.
That's about when I went. I was like, ooh, internet.
Yeah, and it was fast and it was good. And so people showed me some comics that were being put online. They were just like comic strip stuff, like PvP and Penny Arcade and sort of the Keen Spot strips and stuff like that. And so I started to realize that this was a sort of a viable platform and kind of interesting. in many different ways. And then when I finished college and I went to work out west in Calgary, I didn't have a lot of friends. I didn't know a lot of people at first. And so in the evenings, I wanted to keep myself sort of working away creatively, and I started making my own webcomic. And that was sort of my first comic creating, where I wasn't just sort of making sketches or doodling, you know, like just nothings. It was actually a project to try and get pages done and learn. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I'm sure the intent was to learn the craft, but it's not like I thought, oh, this is going to be, you know, a big career or whatever. It was just sort of like I wanted to create something. And I'd send it to my friends as kind of a way of going, you know, hey, this is something I'm doing, and if you guys are watching me do it, then that'll keep me driven. That'll keep me plugging away on it. You know, the plan was 3 pages a week. So Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, I would put up new pages for this little comic story I was doing. And bit by bit, you know, that was a way that I sort of got my work out there and sort of got better at drawing and got better at storytelling. And it was a big sort of changeover once I realized that people could access it from anywhere. Instead of just my friends, I was getting, you know, mail from random strangers, people who found it very organically. And it was around Christmas. So this is, by this time, we fast forward quite a bit. So this is 2001. And it was around Christmas time, and I made a post where I said I was going to take a short break for Christmas. It sounds so weird nowadays because you've got RSS readers and you've got so many easier ways to promote your stuff. But back then, if you lost the bookmark, if people thought you weren't updating your site, they would just drop your bookmark and they wouldn't check on it, and then you would just die. And so I put this post up on the front page, and I said, I'm just taking a 2-week break for Christmas and New Year's. I promise I'll be back in January. Everything's good. And it was this really, like, neurotic message where I was like, I know sometimes the pages aren't good, but I'm trying the best I can, and I really appreciate you guys reading this, and I hope you'll keep reading it because I want you to. And, like, it was just this brutally, you know, neurotic message. And I get an email out of the blue from Scott McCloud, Understanding Comics, Scott McCloud, and he says, we like it. Stop, you know, beating yourself up. It's great. Just make sure you come back. And that totally freaked me out. Yeah, it was just this weird email out of the blue. And so I emailed him back. Oh, my God, Mr. McCloud, I'm such a big fan, and, you know, thank you so much for your support. And he was like, oh, please don't call me Mr. McCloud. You know, call me Scott or whatever. And here's my phone number. Give me a call. And, wow. It was a different time back then, you know, like, I remember it was a big deal the first time I ever found a professional comic artist who had a website. That seemed very strange to me, or I found out that this professional artist had an email address. Like, you knew on one level that they did, but that you could even access that they were literally just a couple clicks away seemed completely foreign and amazing. And so Scott and I had this wonderful conversation. And he told me, you know, webcomics and online comics are coming into their own. And, you know, most people are doing, like, humor strips, and you're doing, like, this dramatic story, and I think it's really neat and kind of different. You should really get more involved with sort of the bigger community. And a few months later, he invited me. He said, you got to come to San Diego Comic-Con. It's where everything happens. And, you know, I'd heard about the show, and I knew it was a big deal, but there was no way I was going to be able to financially make that jump. By this time, I'd moved to Halifax, and so I was working away on the story still. But I, you know, my whole life was financially up in the air, and everything was really crazy. And through him and a few other friends, we basically arranged for, like, crash space on someone's floor and a badge, and my brother got in touch with my dad and basically asked him to help me out. And so my dad bought me a plane ticket to San Diego to go meet a bunch of people I'd never met in person before.
Wow.
It sounds completely insane now that I, you know, when I relate it to people, but it made sense at the time.
It was totally different. I mean, the internet had this, it didn't have that.
There was an intimacy. There was an intimacy too. Yeah. There was a weird sense of trust. If you saw a photo of a person or you talked to them on the phone, it was like, that was a real person. And so, so I ended up going to the show, and I made tons of friends, and it was a wonderful experience, and it really inspired me. Like, I've got to do more of this. I've got to really get on board.
So is that when you got into Skull Kickers?
No, like, I mean, we're talking about at this time, I mean, this is only 2002, 2003, Skull Kickers was still a ways off. But what I would end up doing is I would move back to Toronto, and instead of going back to school, I started working at the Udon Studio with a friend of mine who had been working there, and he recommended me. And so I started doing artwork there, and I started doing eventually just helping organize things around the studio and really learning the nuts and bolts of publishing and project management and art direction and just sort of all the undercarriage that goes into the industry, things that I didn't know anything about publishing, and I didn't know anything about promotion, and I didn't know anything about all these different areas of the industry. And that was a, I mean, in many ways it was super, super valuable stuff, but it was also a big delay on my own personal projects. I kind of put that stuff aside because this was like real commercial work, and I thought, okay, this is important, and I'm going to get some, you know, work credits. And I worked on, through the Udon Studio, I worked on some comic book stuff and some video game stuff and some advertising artwork, and then eventually I would move into like project management, and then I was organizing art teams. It was all really, really valuable stuff. It was an incredible experience. But by the time, I mean, we're talking 2008, so geez, I've been at the studio at that point for, you know, almost 6 years. I could feel this like gnawing frustration that I wasn't doing my own stuff, that I had really kind of mothballed all my own creative plans, and that really drove me crazy. And so I told my boss at the studio that I needed some time out, and I needed to decide what I wanted to do. And I would still do the occasional freelance project, but I wanted to concentrate on some different things. And it was right around the same time that he gave me the opportunity to do some writing at the studio, and I got to collaborate with the same friend who brought me in the first place, and we had this incredible experience making our own comic. We made one of the Street Fighter miniseries, and right around the same time, one of the other artists in the studio, he was invited to do a short story for Pop Gun. And Pop Gun was an image anthology. It's like this big telephone book, you know, thick anthology of pretty much anything goes. And so he got invited to do a short story for that, but he wasn't a writer and he didn't know what he wanted to do. And so we jammed a bunch of ideas, and long story short, we did a short story that was called Two Copper Pieces that was in Pop Gun Volume 2. And Eric Larson was publisher at Image at the time, and he really liked it and asked if we wanted to do a series of it, if we wanted to do an actual full series. This is, I guess, 2008, 2009 maybe, early 2009. And I said, yeah, that would be amazing. The artist and I were totally on board. We did another short story for Pop Gun Volume 3, a really short one. I think it's like 4 pages. And then we started developing Skull Kickers. That was eventually what it was called. And almost immediately, the thing fell apart. This is the sort of the weird part of the whole thing. 2009, the whole thing fell apart. Chris Stevens, he was the original artist on those short stories, and he designed the characters, and he and I had put together the original proposal that was picked up by Eric Larson. But he had crazy financial problems, and you know, creator-owned comics is a big commitment, and it's a big financial commitment, and it's a big time commitment with no guarantees of success on the back end. And the thing with Image, and one of the things that makes them so great, is that you stand to benefit in an incredible amount if it's successful. But if it's not, you're sinking months and months and months with potentially no pay whatsoever. And Chris couldn't financially do that. And I don't, you know, begrudge anyone who can't make that commitment. He's incredibly skilled, and he's a wonderful, wonderful artist. But it was a huge risk, and it was a very difficult, you know, guy's got to eat. Right. And so we mothballed the first script. And as far as I was concerned, it was never going to happen. And that was sort of the weirdest part of all, was it got dunked in a drawer, and it wasn't going anywhere. And about... And this is a rambling story. I hope you guys are up for this.
we have time if you have time. So.
Yeah. So it was about eight or 9 months later. I need to sit down and actually look at the timeline, because I got all the emails still. The Udon Studio received an email from this artist named Edwin Huang, and he was a young kid who was getting ready to graduate from the New York School of Visual Art, I think it's called. And he was taking comics as his specialty, his illustration specialty. And he sent his portfolio to Udon. And at the time, because I was project managing, I was still getting a lot of the submission emails. And people, they didn't know who to send stuff to, but I'd put out some posts basically saying, here's what we're looking for and here's what we're not looking for. So as far as people were concerned, I was the guy they should contact with their portfolios. So he sent me his stuff, and it was good. It was totally solid. And so most people I would send a very, you know, stock kind of cut and paste email. We're not looking for anyone right now. Thanks. Please stay in touch and all this. But I sent him a personal email, and I said, this stuff's really good. You're solid. You've got, you know, you've got what it takes, but the studio's not looking for anyone. So, you know, please don't give up. You do have what it takes. And I gave him some recommends, some specific critique about his portfolio. And one of the things I said to him was, you don't have any room for word balloons on most of your art. Like, if anyone's speaking on this page, it's pretty much going to be brutal. Like, there won't be any room for that dialogue or sound effects. And he said, oh, I said, are you working from a script? Because I would be curious to see how you plotted this page based on the script. And he emailed me right back, and we had a great conversation. And he said, I'm not working from a script. I'm just sort of doing scenes out of my head. And I said, well, you should really work from a script. And he goes, well, can you send me, you know, a script I can work from to develop my portfolio? One of the Street Fighter scripts or one of the other Udon scripts. I said, well, I don't own those scripts. The only script I have that I own that hasn't been drawn is this fantasy comic that I was developing that's currently been mothballed. You're free to look at it, and you're free to look at Chris Stevens' original pencils that he did for a few handful of pages, and you're free to, you know, to like use it as a springboard to practice, and I don't mind giving you critique because you seem like a nice kid. And so we kind of went back and forth over a few emails, and he sent me three or four pages, and they looked amazing. They were really, really solid. They were right on point. And I actually sent Joe Keating, who was one of the, well, you know Joe now, he's doing, you know, all sorts of comic writing, but at the time he was one of the editors for Popgun. I sent Joe an email with a couple of Edwin's sample pages. And Joe emailed me right back, and he goes, oh my God, Chris is drawing the book again. I said, this isn't Chris, this is some like 21-year-old from New York. And he was just flabbergasted that this young kid was knocking him out so strong. And Edwin would end up doing the full first issue as his final project for his illustration course. One of his teachers was Becky Cloonan, and it was so funny. Yeah, and Becky and I are friends now, and it was funny because at the time she was really pushing him hard because she thought he had what it takes, so she was critiquing him really hard. And I was wondering, man, how his pages were coming in so good. But I guess she was giving him critique, and he was really, you know, learning the craft, like really. And his growth in those first couple issues is so astoundingly strong. I remember he would send me pages, and I would do drawing over top, or I would adjust angles or things like that. He was going through what I've sort of termed as like art student syndrome, where you're trying to make every single panel like a full illustration. So he was actually over-rendering things or like choosing more difficult angles because he wanted to impress me or something. And I was like, actually, clear storytelling will impress me. All I need is like simple, clear, especially with comedy. You don't want to go overboard on the rendering. And so he just drilled it out. He did a phenomenal job. And by the time he was finishing the first issue, I was sending emails to people, and I was freaking out. I was like, I got to get this kid to draw the book. Like, I need him to draw the series. How do I ask him, oh, by the way, when you're done this first issue, will you do issue two? Let's be a team. And I was trying to, like, muster up the courage to ask him. And he sent the last page, and with the last page he sent me of issue one, he said, you know, I'll draw this book for you if you want. Which took all the pressure off me. I was like, yeah, that would be great. Thanks.
That's awesome.
And so we were a team from there, you know. And I mean, but to his friends, I guess, in school, it was kind of jaw-dropping because, you know, I took the material. Now, Eric Larson was no longer publisher, so I took it to Eric Stevenson, and I said, you know, Larson approved this pitch. That doesn't mean you have to, like, but will you look at it, you know? And Stevenson turned around, not very long, actually, and said, no problem, we'll do it. And so Edwin was graduating school, you know, with an Image comic coming out within, God, 4 months, 5 months, which is kind of mind-bending, I'm sure, you know. So for him, it was the real launch to his career. And for me, it was a sort of validation that I was going to tell my own stories again. And that's really put me into a real creative explosion since 2010, where I want to do more writing and I want to collaborate and I want to build. And to the point where at the end of late last year, I stepped down from the Udon studio pretty much completely. And I'm just focused on... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, is that what got you started on the education of it all? I we noticed the tutorials, and I want to bring Mark in to talk more about that. But
yeah, we were just wondering when you started doing the
tutorial stuff.
Yeah, like really kind of getting into the dirt of how comics are made, which is really awesome to see.
That was a weird thing. Thanks, man. That was a weird thing. So my day job, like when I wasn't at the Udon Studio, I started teaching when I was out in Calgary. I taught at a small commercial art school there, and I took a break from that. But when I came back to Toronto, another teaching opportunity opened up at a college here called Seneca, and I teach in their art and animation programs. And so I've got this teaching background that's been sort of honed over the last, 10 years. It's scary. But anyways, that's been honed bit by bit. And so I'm obsessed with the discussion of the craft, and I'm obsessed with finding better ways to deliver, information to people. And so my wife convinced me that I should get on Twitter and I should really make the most of that. And so I was on Twitter, and a lot of people were asking me about, well, how do you write a script, or how did you pitch your series to Image? Most creators who are at Image, they were previously established, and no one had really heard of me when Skull Kickers came out. And so they were like, well, how did you pitch that? How did you get that, in front of their face? And what about it, grabbed them? And you're trying to explain to people in 140 character lines on Twitter something that's, a lot more involved. And so I thought, this is annoying. I'm trying to get a bunch of sort of bullet points down. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put together some blog posts that are pretty much, this is what I know about this, about writing or about storytelling or about pitching or about networking. And it's sort of grown into, I guess there's almost 30 of these posts now, both as a way for me to organize my own thoughts and put it into a cohesive fashion that I understand, and also as weirdly as a time-saving measure. So if someone ever asks me, how do you pitch a story, I only have to send them a web link now. Like, I don't have to give them the brush off, and I don't have to be pithy about it, and I don't have to worry that I'm not giving them solid information. Like, if they find that useful, this is what I know. And if you don't find that useful, well, that's all I was going to tell you anyways at the best. So you've got the best version of the information that I can give you, as extensively as I can give it, as organized as I currently know it, and you can take that and use that how you will. And if it's helpful to you, great. And if it's not, then I wasn't going to be helpful to you anyway. So, fill your boots, I guess. Like, it's been a really interesting experience, because I put those out there, like I said, as like a time-saving measure. And then they got passed around quite a bit, and they still do. I guess it's probably, quite easily the most traffic I get on my website is from people who are now a lot of how-tos, a lot of people who want to know how it's done, or they ask me questions about what I've written there, or sometimes they argue with me on some of the points, and it's like, agree or disagree, this is how it works for me. Like, most people don't argue. Most of them are just like pretty pleased to have some examples of scripts or pitches or whatever. But, it's been a really cool experience.
It's interesting to me that people would argue with you about that, because I find that there's
not
just
a major amount of them. Yeah.
Yeah. It just always seems strange to me when people do that, because I mean, you're successful and you're not. I don't believe in any of that I've read you've ever said this is the way that you have to do it, kind of.
Right.
Like, it's all like,
right, and that's a key point there, is I've never said there's only one method, I'm not kind of a zealot about my particular process, and I'm more than willing to adapt as well. I had a script format that I was using that I quite liked, and then Fred Van Lente and Ron Mars gave me the gears, because they didn't like my script format, and Van Lente had this script format that he's been using and refining over years, and he's much more experienced than I am, and he was saying this is what, editors, particularly editors of the big two, want. This is why the format works. And he had a tutorial post all about his script format, and I read that and I said, you're right, that's a totally better way of writing a comic script. That's way more organized and has all your thoughts there, and it's tighter as well. And so I picked up that format and I went back and revised all my tutorials about scripting to include that formatting information, because I think that's the way I currently work. So I want it to be relevant,
Adam and I were talking before we got started. He was really curious about, I guess, the pacing within writing and kind of the difference between working on something like Skull Kickers, where your stories can be like, you know, 3 or 4 pages versus a longer form project, like how you kind of approach those two differently.
Well, I mean, this is the thing with a work for hire project, format determines story, right? So you know by the outset that you've got whatever 22 pages an issue and you're contracted for 4 or 5 issues, and that's all you're going to get. That's the length that you have to play within, and so you have to both fill that space and fill it well and use it dramatically appropriately. And you've got, you know, if it's a 5-part story, you've got 5 breaks, and you've got to make those chapters cohesive and work. You've got to open strong, and you've got to, you know, finish ideally with something intriguing that's going to keep the viewer going. So you've already got these format limitations that are driving your storytelling, and they, for, as a pacing exercise, you're already thinking in terms of that right from the get-go. Or at least I am. I'm very kind of organized and pacing driven. Like I have these pacing sheets that I put together. Okay, these are the things that are happening in this issue. On this page, it's going to happen like this, and sort of each page has a point. Otherwise, it doesn't live in the story, like, you know, and so on and so forth. And then you can figure out how it's going to fit. When you're doing your own story, you've got so much more flexibility. So you can develop it kind of how you want, and you can, in many ways, it's a little bit more intimidating because there's no one forcing you into a certain box.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you find that
box. You can screw it all up.
Yeah. If, I guess whether or not you find that box to be comforting or not. It almost sounds like you're arguing for it being a good thing, which I tend to agree with.
Yeah, I think that it's helpful to have, you know, creator-owned and work-for-hire are two very different processes, and it's like exercising different muscles. So it's like I really enjoy the variety. I love, you know, sometimes the limitations of work-for-hire drive me crazy, and so it's nice to be able to step into my own project and go, no rules, I'm going to do this my way. And then there's other times where it's like, man, I would never have pushed myself to do a project this way, or would never have developed this story without the established material of that work for hire. And that's driving me and pushing me, challenging me, and making me a better writer. And so having both projects underway, and currently I have, it's psychotic for me to even say, I have 7 different comics that I'm working on.
Wow.
While I do my day job. Just psychotic. They're not all monthly. Some of them are miniseries. Some of them are ongoings that haven't been announced yet and stuff like that. But they're it's a lot of stuff. And so I never have to worry about getting stuck, because if I get stuck on one, I just turn the corner and there's another project that I got to work on anyway. So at any time, I'm like, I'm breaking down pacing sheets, or I'm, you know, approving lettering, or colors are coming in and I got to double check them, or I'm uploading files to Image for Skull Kickers, or I'm putting together a proposal and waiting to hear back from an editor, or I'm revising a script, or I'm doing a lettering pass on, like, in any one day I could be working on 4 or 5 different things, and that's not including my day job. So I get home from work and it's just like a flurry of emails and phone calls and Skype and getting caught up on everything that's happened during the day. And that doesn't count, like, I'm at the school and I rush, you know, I eat my lunch in front of my desk and just hack out a bunch of emails, or maybe transcript 2 or 3 pages over my lunch hour or something. So it's a flurry, and I like it. Like, I like being very, very busy, and I like having the variety and not never worrying that I've got something to do. And I never get, if I get stuck, I just, man, there's 20 other things I got to get done, so I'll just do those. And somewhere in the back of my mind, my subconscious will work through the problem that I haven't, you know, figured out yet. I had one of those last night, actually. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Oh, no, I was just... do you have time to just, like, I guess, sketch or just, like, write? I don't really know how a writer sketches, but I know that,
right,
that you do.
Yeah, I started as an artist, so I've still got... I don't draw as much as I used to, obviously. I mean, most of the drawing I do is for school, like whether it's school lessons or drawing, showing students things or things like that. I still do some drawing. I'll do, if it's helpful for me to define a particular layout, I'll draw a quick rough for the artist, or if there's a design idea I have, I might put some stuff down and then let them refine it. I had a page today that Edwin sent me. It's pretty rare nowadays that I have to change anything that Edwin draws because he's phenomenal. I mean, his growth has been incredible. But there was an angle today on this one panel that wasn't working, and so I just did a quick sketch over top, and I go, this is how I saw it in my head when I was writing it. And most of the time, I'm not that specific. Like, I don't need it to be exactly how I imagined it. If it's got all the storytelling beats and it works, then I'm more than happy. But the panel, as the way he'd drawn it, was missing a particular part of the storytelling, and so I said, this will fit everything. Let's do it like this, you know. And stuff like that, or sometimes it's just like coloring. Like I had some artwork coming in for a new project, and the colors were just a little bit bland, and so I told the colorist, I said, can you just send me the layered files, and I'll just tweak it, and I'll show you what we need. And then I upload it back to him, and then all the rest of the page, it's like the palette that he's going to use for the rest of the scene or whatever. I try not to be too art director finicky about stuff, but obviously with creator-owned, I'm going to be more particular than with the commercial stuff where there's an editor doing that stuff. So,
Do you get time to play with like I guess just go through like writing exercises or stuff that is not going to see the light of day?
No, not anymore. No, I mean I've got some story ideas and proposals that I'm sort of I'll hack down some point form notes or some little element of the story will break in my mind, and I'll quickly type down a couple ideas as they come to me so that I don't forget them. Or sometimes a title. Like I've got a text file that's just sitting on my desktop that's just weird titles of things. I don't even know what half of them would be, but they sound neat. And so I've got those sort of, they just sit on my desktop. So that's about the only play that I get, is every so often I'm sitting there and I'm like walking downtown and all of a sudden a neat title will come to me and I go, oh, I got to write that on my phone or send myself an email so I don't forget it. And then I add that to the little text file. But to be totally honest, I have like no time for fun writing or fun drawing most of the time. Just because of the work stuff. And it's neat to me that because I've got all these projects on the go, all of them are, they're all progress in some way. They're all going to be published at some point. And, you know, when it works well, it doesn't feel like work. Like, it's a lot of fun, and it's a lot of, every new bit of art that I'm getting from an artist, new pages are coming in this barrage every day, and that inspires me to just, I got to do more, I got to keep rolling, I got to keep, building stuff. And so it's like feeding the machine now in a very cool way where the creativity seems to be flowing really well. I don't know if I can keep this pace up, but right now it's great. Right now it's a lot of fun.
What do you got coming up?
I can't say all of them, but I can talk about some of the stuff. So Skull Kickers is entering its fifth story arc, which is crazy to me. So issue 25 comes out later this month, I think on March, I want to say 26th, whatever the Wednesday is. I think it's 25th, 26th. Issue 25 comes out. 25 issues, holy crap. And then we've got Pathfinder City of Secrets, which is based on the award-winning role-playing game.
I love that game, by the way.
Published by Dynamite. Fun. And so the new series of that starts in May. In April I've got One Shot. Red Sonja and Cub is coming out from Dynamite as well. I got to write Red Sonja basically in Katai, which is like the eastern part of Hyboria. So it's all sort of Asian samurai warriors and ninjas and the like with Red Sonja chopping people's faces off. It is absolutely fantastic. It was a lot of fun. Jonathan Lau's drawing that. He drew the heck out of it. He did a wonderful job. Oh, geez, it's getting crazy now. I've got Samurai Jack is continuing. So originally, that's from IDW, continuing the award-winning Cartoon Network show. Originally, it was supposed to be just a 5-issue miniseries, and then it sold really well, so they extended us to 10, and it's continuing to do well, so they've extended us to 15. So that'll take us through the end of the year, and I really just want to keep writing it as long as they'll let me. I've been writing up a storm on that, and those issues are just continuing monthly without any break, which is insane, but whatever, it's getting done. I've got a new, it just got announced last week, and by the time your podcast goes up, it will be already online. I'm doing the new Disney Kingdom series for Marvel, which is based on Journey into Imagination and Figment. So it's the Disney sort of Epcot ride that, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean was a Disney ride, and they found that worked out pretty well for them. So Disney wants to develop a bunch of their rides into sort of franchises of storytelling and figuring out character and plot. And so I was approached by Marvel about that late last year, and I've been working with the Disney Imagineers on that, and it's been a really amazing experience. And they've been very
cool. Do you have to wear the hat with the ears?
No, it's they've been awesome. Like, I went into that project so intimidated because I was like, what do I know? These Imagineer guys, they know everything, and they're going to want something very specific. But they were really open to me fleshing out the mythology of this thing and figuring out who these characters were, Figment and Dreamfinder, and coming up with even new characters that they're going to interact with on their adventures. And my Marvel editor, Bill Roseman, he's been fantastic. He's been really cool to work with. So it's my first Marvel gig, and hopefully not my last one. Holy crap, I've got so much stuff coming out. I did a Suicide Squad one-shot for DC with Amanda Waller. It's a double-sized issue. I think it's like 40 pages, all about the leader of the Suicide Squad and sort of what makes her tick and why she would start this crazy strike force of villains. I don't know how much you know about the Suicide Squad, but it's a really cool concept. And so, and that's been getting some extra coverage because the Suicide Squad is showing up in the Arrow TV show this season. And so I didn't know that when we were developing this issue, but the timing is fortuitous. So I'm pretty happy about that. Yeah, it's kind of nice.
Is this workload typical for you, or is this a particularly busy year?
This is a little intense. This is a little intense. Well, it was funny because in December, I had three different projects that I pitched on, and typically I would only get one of them, maybe two of them if I was lucky, and all three of them came through, and they were all like, yep, you're the guy, and I kind of laughed about it because it was so ridiculous because I didn't think that was going to happen, and I told my wife, I said, I can handle one or two of these, no problem, and then all three came through, and I'm like, what am I going to do, complain? Like, this is amazing. I've got so much stuff, you know, that's on the go. I've got another project proposal in at IDW, and I've got a new creator-owned book starting in August. Other than that, nothing. Pretty bored.
I got nothing else on.
Just relaxing. I think that was like 5 minutes straight of me just describing projects right now.
So you have time to eat and sleep in between all this, I assume.
And teach and stuff, too, It's a little intense. When I'm on a scripting role, things can go relatively quick. I had just a brutal month last month with February, and so I went away to this art and animation festival over in England called Animex, which is one of my favorite conventions I go to each year. And so I lost a solid week of productivity, and all these scripts ended up log jamming at the end of the month. And thank God we had the sort of equivalent of March break at our school was in the last week of February. So I just stayed home for 7 days and just scripted. And I did 65 pages of script in 7 days and got all my deadlines and hit everything on the mark. And everyone was super happy.
Yeah. So with all this going on, out of curiosity, do you have an agent, or do you think that's important at all?
I don't have an agent. There's a company that was repping Skull Kickers, so they're called Surge, and they're the same guys that used to rep Eastman and Laird for the Turtles, and they also repped Axe Cop and got them the Fox show. And so they're really great guys, and they've been very nice, but they're specifically repping Skull Kickers. They're not repping me, so... Yeah. They've been great. There's no, you know, it hasn't really been an issue. Not with the comic business, anyways.
So you don't feel that you personally need representation for yourself?
Not at this point, no. And I don't know a lot of people that have that. I mean, I think when you hit a level of like a Mark Miller or a Neil Gaiman or someone like that, I think that's when an agent is probably more than useful. But I know some pretty big guys in the business, like, you know, and they, yeah, most of them don't have an agent. Most of them are, at this point, guys who are doing consistent Marvel and DC work, they generally don't need an agent. I think once you start getting into the media end of things, if they're developing a movie or if you've got a TV show or if you're moving into sort of those bigger arenas where the contracts are much deeper and stranger and more labyrinthian, I think then you might, you know, that's where you can really benefit from having, like, I've got a lawyer that I send contracts to, but, you know, that's when you want an agent, I think, to keep your head above water. So
I noticed in the writing world, it's a little sooner than the, you know, Neil Gaiman level. You know, they seem to find it just a little. They seem to get it when they've got a little bit of momentum going and some popularity building, and they prove that they can do something on their own. They can market themselves, and then the reps come in. And
yeah, I think comics don't pay well enough for the agent fees. That's probably
Yeah. Doesn't pay well for the writing too much either, from what I understand.
Well, prose or comics?
Yes. I mean,
it can vary pretty wildly. I think that was one of the things that I try and explain to people. They're like, oh, you know, you're writing all these books, you must be making really good money. I'm like, oh, it depends on the project. Like, some of them can be really good, and some of them are just sort of, they're okay, you know. The nice thing about having the teaching with a day job is that I'm never taking a project that I don't want to do, and I'm never feeling like I'm getting screwed over. Like, if a project falls through, my first thing isn't, oh, there goes the mortgage, you know what I mean? Like, that's not my so first concern.
You don't ever feel like you have to take something just... I mean, it sounds like you didn't have that problem recently, obviously, with all the stuff you're doing now.
But yeah.
You didn't feel like... Have you ever really felt like, I really should just do that, even though I may not be the best fit?
A good fit?
Yeah, yeah.
I think the first... Let's say, you know, 2010, 2011, I'd have taken anything because I just wanted to get my name out there. But even over the last... I'm not saying this to sound cocky, but like over the last 3 weeks, I've probably turned down 3 projects, wow. You know? And so some of them are small ones, some of them are bigger ones, but they weren't a good fit, and or the timeline was terrible or whatever, you know? And so it happens, you know? It's not like I won't take everything.
Right.
You know, I know the freelancer mentality is just, you know, fill yourself till you burst or whatever, because you never know if there's going to be work there later. But, I have turned down stuff. It's not like I'm not at the trough, you know, like, over, you know, being
friends. Well, we spoke with another artist, and he was saying that, you know, if you're not a good fit, most likely the work you put out won't be your best work.
Agreed.
So that seems to be a big prevailing ideal or idea.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, for a lot of people, you've got to sort of know your limitations or know, you know, that you're going to put yourself into it. Especially when you're talking about a creative process like writing, you want to make sure, you know, my name's going to be on the front cover. And I want it to be something that I'm proud of. And that's not to say that every project is going to be exactly the way I want or that everything is aces all the way through. But more often than not, you've got to go in, you know, with the right attitude. You've got to go in with the best of intentions and with the strength of wanting to do this thing. And so I know that can be really difficult because – and it's not something you can really say to people, you know – it's not like I tell my friends, and I've got friends who are creative and they want to be doing more in this business. It's not like I walk up to them and go, yeah, I turned down a project today. Like, you know, you don't want to be like a jerk. Everyone's at different points of their development, you know, in this business. And so everyone's different, you know, and the same thing when I'm talking to other people. I know people who are, they're much further along that path than I am, and the projects that they turn down are the ones that I would be scrambling after, you know, but that's just different parts of the process, different parts of the career. And you've got to sort of take that in stride and know, be comfortable with where you're at along that path. Otherwise, you'll never be happy. You know, you'll just be frustrated and wishing you were someone else. And that's a mind-bending, you know, thing that will never get better unless you get clarity. So,
I agree. All right, Mark, got anything else you want to jump in on before we wrap up?
Yeah, Jim, I did have a question that I wanted to ask you about. You know, with Skull Kickers and doing the stuff for Pathfinder, I was curious if you ever incorporate dice or chance into how you write stories. I've actually experimented with it, and it's a lot of fun. I don't know if you said earlier you don't get a chance to write for fun, but...
I haven't. It's weird because with the gaming stuff, you'd think it would be such a natural fit. But the good thing is I have years and years of Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop gaming sort of under my belt, and so there's a feeling of randomness to some of the stuff. There's a feeling of chaos to some of the combat, and that I think is finally honed from all the years at the gaming table. But I don't generally leave it to chance when I'm developing the stories themselves. That being said, although I don't play in a regular role-playing game, I do. We usually have board game nights, and we tend to get groups together, and we do stuff that can be played in one night, or stuff that can be played in an hour or so. You know, because you just don't have time for an ongoing campaign. And there's a game called Fiasco, which is almost—it's less of a game. Like, there's no competitive element. It's like a storytelling exercise of a game, and it'll play out in maybe 3-4 hours at the most. And you're doing these quick little scenes with your friends, and you're developing a story in real time. And unlike a Dungeons and Dragons game or something, it's all going to wrap up tonight. And so you will do things with these characters, or you will sacrifice these characters that you're playing, because it works with the narrative rather than worrying about, oh, what are we going to play next week, you know. And so that's been one of the more kind of creative, random kind of building elements I've experienced recently. And it was really, really fun. And really stretched a bunch of creative muscles. And my friend Will Heinmarch, he's written a bunch of scenarios for Fiasco, and he actually wrote a tutorial all about how he took one of the Fiasco games and turned it into a short story, and was able to use that as a springboard for a bunch of character development and creativity. So
that's really cool. I've used a game called Mythic. There's just some random... I've never seen it in print. I paid for a PDF off the guy who developed its site. But
nice.
I imagine it's kind of similar. You like roll dice on a chaos board with kind of like words that you pair up, and then you like a story building exercise. It's really cool. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I think that's what's so great about it is you know, they just become tools for your creativity. Mm-hmm. And they become ways for you to sort of kickstart your brain or get you thinking about synergies between despondent items that you wouldn't normally think about. And I think that that's a really powerful, you know, if you're stuck on something, or if, you know, I talk to people all the time and they say to me, oh, I've always wanted to write my own stories, or I want to make my own comic. And I never want to sound pithy about it, because I know it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. But part of me does want to say, you can, you know, but you have to begin doing it. Like, you have to really hunker down and make time for it. And when people say, oh, well, I'm really busy, you know, and then I say, I don't know if you know this, but I'm very busy too. but if you make the time, and if you make it a priority to do the creative exercise and to build, you will get stuff done, but you've got to really push to do that. I'll give you an example. So my friend Cullen Bunn, he's writing a bunch of stuff for Marvel, and he writes The Sixth Gun at Oni Press, and he's done a whole ton of comics over the past few years. And he and I had this wonderful conversation, we were talking about him leaving his day job. He used to work at an insurance office, and, you know, the same kind of thing. People would say to him, oh, I always wanted to write, but I never find time to write. And he explained to me his schedule and how he would wake up at 6 in the morning to write for an hour before his kids would wake up, and then he'd go to work, and then when his friends would go out for lunch, he'd stay at his desk and he'd write for an hour. And then he'd put his kids to bed, and his wife would go to bed, and he would write for 2 hours. So he would get 4 hours of writing a weekday done, right? And that's a guy who's very busy, very, very busy. But he got 4 hours of writing in because it was a priority, because that's what he wanted to do. And that's how he was able to build his career, you know? And that's not to say that if you write for 4 hours a day, you will become a professional writer at Marvel. Like, everyone's path is different. But the point is that he definitely paid his dues, and he busted his butt, and he built, you know, his work, and he improved his craft, and he's benefited from that a great deal. And I think that that's aspirational for people who And to also understand that the goals will change. That, you know, when I was in school taking art, I wanted to work for Disney, and I wanted to be a Disney animator and, like, move to California or whatever, or work for Pixar or something like that. And, you know, years have gone by, and I've done all sorts of different things, completely different from my original plan. And now, in the weirdest, most roundabout ways, I'm doing a Disney project. But I'm writing it, you know, but I'm developing it with the park. And it's not like, I wouldn't call it destiny by any means, but, you know, there is a sense that it's all come around in its own way. And it's not, I'm not doing what I thought I would be doing, but the drive that I had earlier in my career has led to opportunities that I've been able to capitalize on. And that's a good feeling.
What do you think is one of the biggest roadblocks that, you know, the people that say, I really want to do it, and then you say do it, and they're like, well, I mean, what do you think is keeping them from, is it fear, or?
I think it's fear. I think it's also, in your mind, any story that you develop is kind of perfect, and it's successful, and it's the way you imagine it's going to be, and it never has to go through a critiquing phase, because it's just all up there percolating in your mind, and you're already finished, and it's wonderful, and people love it. And then when you put it on paper, and you crystallize that and you make it a physical thing, it will never be the imaginative perfection. It will be real, and you'll make mistakes, and the art will not look the way you think it's going to, and the printed book may not be exactly what you wished for, but that's sort of the alchemy of making the thing. And you have to realize that the first thing you make is never going to live up to your expectations, and the second one and the third one, but by doing it, you will build up build up your skills and build up your craft. And now, you know, occasionally I get a project that's better than I imagined, or it goes even in better places than I'd hoped, and I think that's because I've made mistakes and gotten better, or I can roll with sort of the challenges in a way because of my experience. And you have to go through that phase. One of the things I say to my students, there's a point usually in there around second semester, third semester, where their ability to analyze and recognize quality outstrips their ability to create quality. And that is the point when most artists run away, when they freak out, because they now know that they do not know. Do you know what I mean? Like they can recognize that their own work is not of professional quality, and they recognize what professional quality is, and they're not currently producing it. And they can't fathom getting to that point, and so they freak out. And it's a really brutal stage when all the classes are freaking out because they know that there's something wrong, and they assume that it can never be overcome, and that they will always suck, and that they will always be producing, you know, unprofessional work.
That's like one of the hardest places to be as an artist.
It's brutal, but it's
so bad.
Right, at least if you recognize it, you have the tools to move past it. Not easily, not instantly, but you have the ability to know how close you are getting to the goal. Whereas there are people who are producing content and they can't even see the forest for the trees. They don't realize what they're producing, how subpar it is, you know? And occasionally you'll see those people wandering around a convention with a portfolio that looks extremely, extremely unprofessional, and that's the nicest way I can put it. And their heart is on the page, but it's not good enough. And when they get a critique, they feel like they've been hit with a harpoon, like that you're killing them because this is their dream. But they can't see the difference between their work and the professional work. They know the professional work is better on some vague level, but they think it's, you know, talent or magic or whatever you want to call it. And that's the tough part. I feel like, don't get me wrong, like I don't know everything, and I'm definitely growing and learning, and I think I'm a better writer now than I was last year, and hopefully next year I'll be better still. But at this point, I've gone through enough, at least, that I can sort of recognize, okay, this is the part of the process where I think the script sucks, and I will keep working at it, and I will solve the problem. Or this is the part when I feel like an amateur, and I will work my way around this difficulty and it will come together. You know, like I can see a pattern in my own sort of booms and busts creatively, and know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel because I've done it enough times. And I think that's a very valuable thing to have.
I think that you know, or you can see that light at the end of the tunnel because you've done it so many times.
Right.
Someone asked me the other day how to panel, like how to arrange your panels in a comic. And
right.
The only answer I could give them was just, you know, make a ton of pages with panels, you know, and as you do it, the pacing and everything starts to make sense and it becomes intuitive to some degree. But
yeah.
you can't get it until you do it, and making mistakes and screwing up is so important to that process.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's like I look at some of my original comic pages or I look at some of my original stories and I can see all the flaws in them, but I'm so thankful that I went through that phase of doing those pages so that I can see that, so that I can know that I'm better at it, you know what I mean? And even the first volume of Skull Kickers, it, you know, I don't feel like it's at a level of revisionism where I want to go back and redo it, but I can see how we would do it better. I can see how I would approach it now. And what I would do now, you know? So it's like, so the new creator-owned book that I'm going to launch in August, I feel like is benefiting from all the tracks and all the things I've learned, you know? And last year, I literally scripted 1,000 pages of comics. And it was like, damn, like, that's a lot of damn comic, you know? Like, and so I benefited from that. The creator-owned book I'm doing now, I've got literally a couple thousand pages of comics behind me on the trail, you know, in my rearview mirror, and the story that I'm writing now will benefit from all that growth and development.
Practice.
Yeah, I've been trying to crack out as many minis this year as possible. My goal was one a week, which I'm behind on that, but
right.
I think last year I didn't really do much of anything. I just drew pictures every day, which is something.
Well, you know, which is something as well. But this is the thing too, is that one of the only things I tell people now is, as you know, people tell me how great the tutorial stuff I wrote is, and I'm thankful. I'm very thankful that they're finding it helpful. I said, just make sure you're not stuck in a feedback loop of tutorial reading. You know what I mean? I think people get obsessed with craft and they get obsessed with reading and trying to find like the alchemy, the perfect formula that they think is going to solve all their problems. And the only consistent one is doing. Like, it's really helpful to read about how other people are doing stuff, and it's really helpful to see other people's process, and it's really great to know that there's all this material of learning, and you should partake in that, but just make sure that that doesn't become the obsession over the doing, because the doing is the thing. The doing is the one that's going to really make the difference. And you know, start with short stories if you're intimidated by long form stuff. Start with really short stuff. Start with simple concepts. If you can deliver a simple concept, then deliver something more complex. Don't start with your Lord of the Rings epic, you know. That if you go into something so big and so broad and so massive, you'll lose momentum and you'll lose hope, and then you won't get anything finished. But if you finish a 3-page story or a 6-page story or something like that, you'll see the progress and the feedback that much quicker, and you'll know that you're able to complete things. There are a lot of people I know that, even working professionals in the business, and I talk to them. I mean, these are really well-established people, and they say to me, oh, I don't know about creator-owned. I like having someone else telling me the deadline and telling me the parameters. You know, creator-owned just feels like this weird, open-ended, you know, never-ending, who's gonna crack the whip? And I'm like, well, you've got to crack the whip. Like, you've got to care. You've got to want to do it. If you're not, you know, there's been a couple artists that, you know, Skull Kickers launched in 2010, and I've had a couple smaller projects, but this new one coming in August is my first big kind of creator-owned project since then. And the reason why it's taken 4 years is because I've worked with other artists, and it wasn't going to work out, and I knew, you know, we would get a handful of pages pulled together, and I'm like, well, that took 3 months. How are we going to do an issue? You know, how are we going to do a trade? This isn't going to happen. You know, what is this going to, this thing's never going to get finished. And so it's like I pulled off the Band-Aid fast. I just went, you know what, you're awesome. I like you. I also want to continue to be your friend. It's like, you know, there are people that you like, and there are people you can work with, and they are not always the same people. And there are people that you like, and there are people you can live with, you know, as roommates, and they're not always the same people. And a creator-owned book is like, It's like, we just became roommates. Like, we're in it now, man. Like, we're, you know, this is a relationship. We got to carry this thing to the hoop, and we got to, you know, push each other and support each other and make this thing really happen. And it can't be one person doing all the pushing. Like, it's impossible, you know.
Have you ever had to make changes midway through or near a certain turning point?
In terms of commercial stuff for creator owned or
well yeah, because I noticed with Skull Kickers you've got you've got multiple people working on one thing.
Right. So I mean we've got our multiple colorists usually, although Misty's the main colorist, we've got a couple other colorists who can dive in and help on a deadline. We've done short stories and stuff, so in between each story arc I'll have people come in and do joke short stories. And that's more of a fun thing where I get to have other people draw the characters. That's more been like a fun exercise rather than a, oh my God, we need you to come in. But the actual main story is always drawn by Edwin.
Okay.
And so I'd rather take a break, and we take breaks between story arcs and build up the buffer of material rather than burn him out or have stuff come out sort of on a random schedule. You know, the reason why the fifth arc is starting now is because we've got material buffer. We've actually got 3 issues in the can. Oh my God, we got 3 issues in the can. it's such a good feeling. And then the minute you send one off to print, you're like, well, there goes 1 of 3 in the
buffer. Okay, now we have 2 in the can.
Yeah, now I got 2 in the can. Oh God, we got to get another one done, you know. Same thing with this book in August. Like, we're cranking out on the first issue now. I would love to have it done by the start of April and then have the second issue done by the end of, you know, by the start of May. And then we announced the book end of May, and I've already got 2 in the can. Like, that would be the ideal schedule. But, you know, we'll see if reality corresponds to my dream, you know. So
life always has its way of throwing up roadblocks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, but you push through.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. That's how you succeed, I guess. So
yeah.
That's how you succeed, is you push through.
Yeah, totally. I think that one of the weird things is because I've been doing this for quite a while, I mean, if you get right down to it, my first comic that I did for myself was 2001, so we're here 13 years later, but most people didn't know who I was. My name didn't pop up on anyone's radar probably outside of webcomics until 2010. So you've got 9 years where I was doing stuff, but no one knew who I was, creatively speaking. And so when people tell me, man, you came out of nowhere, I'm like, yep, that's a 9-year overnight sensation, you know. Right.
Yeah. You're a journeyman. That's what they call you. In baseball, they call you a journeyman minor leaguer.
That's right.
But all right, well, I think you're a busy man. We've kept you long enough.
Thanks, man.
So we'll get you back to work. Mark, thank you for joining us, and as always... and as he salutes.
Yeah, no one can hear that.
Can I do one more thing, actually?
Yeah.
For your listeners, if they don't know my work, they can find me online at jimzub.com, so JIMZUB.com, and my Twitter handle is just JIMZUB. I've got all sorts of tutorials, as we mentioned before.
Yes, and check those out.
Up to
all those sorts tutorials of good stuff. Are great.
Yeah, and lots of new stuff getting announced over the next couple months.
Awesome.
Good times.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'll make sure that we put everything in the notes so people can, as they're reading stuff or at the site, they can click on it and go straight to it. So
awesome.
It's been really great talking with you, Jim. Big fan of your work.
Absolute pleasure.
Call Kickers
is
awesome.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for joining us.
Take care now.
So, yeah, I think a trip to Toronto is in order. Anybody want to go? That sounds like a pretty great place. I mean, I want to check out some of the events going on there, the comic convention and other things. It sounded like a blast. So, anyway, I have to admit something. I didn't know that Toronto was the biggest city in Canada. I guess I never thought about it. Does that show myself of that border ignorance? I apologize to the Canadians. I didn't know. I mean, I was in Canada once for about 2.5 hours, and then we bolted. Not anything against Canada again. It's just we had to leave. So it was a crazy night. It was a drive. It was a crazy. I'm gonna stop talking about it. Anyway, but yeah, I would like to go to Toronto. I've heard some nothing but great things about it. So yeah, I'll have to check that out. Anyway, I like when Jim was talking about the art student syndrome. He was working on a project with a young artist, and the guy was just seemed to be trying too hard with panels, and even Jim mentioned over-rendering just in order to impress Jim. And he had one thing to say. He said, "Clear storytelling will impress me," and I think that stands for a lot of things. I know even some of the greatest songs out there are very simple in structure and just clear. So, yeah, I thought that stood out. Also, I kind of opened up a can of worms there when I asked him what he was working on and what he had coming up. Holy crap, that guy is a machine. He's teaching. He's got countless projects. He's editing. And you know what's even crazier? The man likes it. I mean, that is some serious respect right there. He enjoys it, and that's good stuff. So good for him. Jim, thank you very much for joining us. Mark and I had a really good time with that. And also thanks to Michael Freely, who suggested we reach out to Jim and try and get him on the show. That was a fantastic idea. If you have someone that you would also like to hear on the podcast, send me an email to ag@makingcomics.com. I will do my best. Okay, so we are in the third week of the MOOC, and I tell you what, it has been pretty exciting. I know I mentioned last week how awesome it's been just to see all what people have been coming up with, and nothing has changed in that week. It has just been some fantastic ideas and just great stuff. Also, the live panels that we're having on Wednesday nights, the Gutter Talk Live episodes, those are also just as fun. If you're missing them, no worries. What we're going to do is we're going to turn those into podcasts for the month of May. Each week will correspond with the weeks of the MOOC. So that's going to be pretty exciting. So you'll get to hear the edited version. if you're privy to catching the unedited versions, it's been fun. Anyway, so yeah, we'll have those up for you in May. And the cool thing about May is there are 5 Fridays. So that means that 5th Friday, we're going to be reissuing number 2, the Jason Brubaker Making Comics original, the OG of Making Comics podcast. So we're going to reissue that. So yeah, going to be a fun month. All right. If you want to find me, I am on Twitter. I try to hide from people physically, but I'm kidding. I am on Twitter at SDGreeny, SDGreeny. Hit me up. Also, you can shoot me an email at ag@makingcomics.com. I want to hear from you. I put this out a little while ago, and I haven't heard from really many people. I think I've had like 2 emails. So yeah, say hi. You know, I want to hear from you. What are you listening? Am I just doing this? Am I just talking into this microphone with my cat sleeping next to me? Is she the only one hearing me? Well, I think that about wraps it up. I think that's a pretty good darn spot to call it done, because I think I'm losing it. Be good to people.